Looking in the silver bowl at this juncture seemed like a bad idea. Quentin stood up. "Listen, if you can't help us, fine, we'll go. But if you can help us, give us a price. We'll pay it."
"Oh, but I don't have to give you anything at all. I did not invite you here, and I will decide when you can go. Look in the bowl."
Now there was steel in that high, whispery voice.
"Look in the bowl."
This was going south fast. It felt all wrong. He took Julia's arm and pulled her to her feet. "We're leaving," he said. "Now." He backhanded the silver bowl off the table, and it clanged against the wall. A slip of paper fluttered out of it. Against his better judgment, Quentin glanced at it. There were spells you could set off just by reading them. The paper had the words, "I owe you one magic button," written on it, in crude magic marker. The door opened behind them, and Quentin scrambled to get them both behind the table.
"Oh, shit! He looked in the bowl!"
The voice was a lot lower than the one that had been speaking before. It was a voice Quentin knew well. It belonged to Josh. Quentin hugged him.
"Jesus,"
he said into Josh's broad, comforting shoulder.
"What the hell, man?"
He didn't understand how it was even possible that Josh was here, but it didn't matter. Probably it would, but not yet. He didn't even care that Josh had messed with their heads. What mattered now was that they weren't going to have a new disaster. They weren't going to have a fight. Quentin's knees were shaking. It was like he'd sailed so far from the safe, orderly world he knew that he was coming back around the other way, from the other side. And there was Josh, an island of warmth and familiarity. Josh disengaged himself tactfully.
"So," he said, "welcome to the suck, man."
"What the hell are you doing here?"
"Me? This is my house. What are you doing here? Weren't you in Fillory?"
He was the same Josh, round-faced, overweight, grinning. He looked like a beer-brewing abbot, not visibly older than the last time Quentin had seen him, which was more than 3 years now. Josh carefully closed the door behind him.
"Can't be too careful," he said. "Got an image to protect. Kind of Wizard of Oz thing going on, if you see what I mean."
"What's with the bowl?"
"Hey, I didn't have a lot of time. I just thought it was creepy. You know, look in the bowl. Look in the bowl."
He did the voice. "Josh, Julia, you guys know each other." They'd met once before in the chaotic run-up before the great return to Fillory, before Josh had set off into the Netherlands on his own.
"Hi, Julia."
Josh kissed her on both cheeks. He must have really gone Euro over here.
"Hi."
Josh waggled both eyebrows at Quentin lewdly in a way that didn't seem like it should be physically possible. It was starting to sink in for Quentin just what a colossal stroke of luck this was. Josh would have the magic button. He was their ticket back to Fillory. Their wandering days were over.
"So, listen," he said, "we've got some problems."
"Yeah, you must, if you came here." "We don't even really know where here is."
"You're in my house. That's where here is."
Josh waved his arms grandly.
"Here is a huge fuck-off palazzo on the Grand Canal."
He gave them the tour. The palazzo was 4 floors, the lower 2 for business, the upper 2 for Josh's private apartments, to which they retreated. The floor was massive, pink-swirled marble slabs, the walls crumbling plaster. All the rooms were odd sizes and seemed to have been built as they were needed on a series of whimsical impulses that was now impossible to reconstruct. All glory to the great quest for Fillory, but they needed a break. Julia requested a hot bath, which, frankly, she badly needed. Quentin and Josh retired to the tremendous dining room, which was lit by a single, modest chandelier. Over plates of black spaghetti, Quentin explained as best he could what had happened and why they were here.
When he was done, Josh explained what had happened to him. With Quentin, Elliot, Janet, and Julia safely installed on the thrones of Fillory, Josh had taken the button and embarked on an exploration of the Netherlands. He'd seen as much as he ever wanted to see of Fillory, and it hadn't been pretty, and anyway he was sick of scraping along in the others' shadows. He didn't want to be co-king of Fillory. He wanted to do his own thing, his own way. He wanted to find his own Fillory. He wanted to get laid. Josh could be careless about a lot of things. What he ate, wore, smoked, said, did. But you don't get into break bills without being a genius of some kind or another. And given the right stakes, he was fully capable of being highly methodical, even meticulous. In this case, the stakes were just right. He began a careful survey of the Netherlands. This was not a thing to be undertaken lightly. As far as anyone knew, the squares and fountains of the Netherlands extended an infinite distance in all directions, never repeating themselves, and each one led to a different world, and maybe a whole different universe. It would take no effort at all to get so lost that you could never find your way home. Josh had it in mind to go to Middle-earth, as in the setting of Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. Because if Fillory was real, why not Middle-earth? And if Middle-earth was real, that meant a lot of other things were probably real. Lady elves and lembas wafers and pipeweed and Uru Iluvatar knew what else. But practically speaking, anywhere would have done as long as it was reasonably warm and life-supporting and inhabited by people endowed with the appropriate organs and a willingness to make them available to Josh. The multiverse was his TGI Fridays. He had it in mind to spiral outward from Earth's fountain, square by square, mapping carefully as he went. He wouldn't need much. You didn't really get hungry in the Netherlands. He brought a loaf of bread, a good bottle of wine, warm clothes, 6 ounces of gold, and a stun gun. "The first world was a complete bust," he said. "Desert everywhere, incredible dunes, but no people at all that I could find. So I buttoned right back out of there. Next one was ice. Next one was pine forest. Next one was inhabited, sort of a Native American thing. I stayed there 2 weeks. No love, but I lost about 10 pounds. Also scored a fuck ton of wampum." "Wait, hang on. These worlds were the same all over? Like each one had a single climate and that's it?" "Well, I don't know. I don't even know if these other worlds are spheres, you know, or disc worlds, or ring worlds, whatever else. Maybe they don't work the same way. Maybe they don't have latitude. But I wasn't about to hike to another climatic zone just to find out. Much easier just to hit the next fountain." "God, the things I saw. Really, you should do it sometime. Some days I would hit a dozen worlds. I was just like free-falling through the multiverse, a giant tree that didn't have any beginning or end, a sort of magnetic world where everything stuck to you. One was all stretchy. One was just stairs, stairs and stairs and stairs. What else? There was an upside-down one, a weightless one where you drifted around in outer space, except that space was warm and humid and smelled sort of like rosemary. And you know what's real? Teletubbies. I know, right? Crazy, crazy stuff." "You didn't." "No, I did not hit that shit. Totally could have. Anyway, not everything was that exotic. Sometimes I'd find a world that was just like ours. Only one tiny thing would be different. Like the economy was all based on strontium, or sharks were mammals, or there was more helium in the air, so everybody had little high voices. I did meet a girl after all that. Man, it was so beautiful. This world was mostly mountains, like one of those Chinese paintings, just rising out of the mist, and actually everybody looked kind of Asian. They lived in these ornate, hanging pagoda cities. But there were hardly any of them left. They were always fighting these endless wars with other people on other mountains, for no special reason. Plus, they fell off cliffs a lot. I was probably the fattest person they'd ever seen, but they didn't care about that. I think they thought it was hot, like it meant I was a good hunter, something like that. They'd also never seen magic before, so that went a long way. I was kind of a celebrity for a while. I started hanging out with this one girl, big-time warrior for one of the cities. She was very into the magic thing. And also, I guess their menfolk weren't especially well endowed in the hardware aisle, if you take my meaning. I believe I grasp the essence of it, yes, Quentin said. Anyway, she died, got killed. It was awful, really, really sad. At first I wanted to stay and fight and try to get the people who killed her, but then I couldn't do it. It was also stupid. I just couldn't get into the war thing the way they did, and that was shameful to them, I guess. So they kicked me out. God, I'm sorry. Poor Josh. The way he talked all the time, you sometimes forgot he had feelings. But they were all there, if you dug deep enough. No, it doesn't matter. I mean, it did, but what can you do? It was never going to work out. I think she wanted to die that way. Those people weren't that into life. Or maybe they were, and that's what life is. I don't fucking know. That's when it all went to shit. All the fun was gone. I went to this kind of Greek world, white cliffs and hot sun and dark seas. I slept with a harpy there. You had rebound sex with a harpy? I don't know if that's what she was. Wings for arms, basically. Her feet were kind of talony, too. Right. She practically took off in the middle of it, feathers going everywhere. Way more trouble than it was worth. I still have a scar from where she clawed me. I don't want to see it. Josh sighed. All the humor had drained out of his face, leaving it gray under the stubble. Now Quentin saw those years that he'd missed before. I mean, all I was looking for basically was some kind of why the last man set up, right? Where I was the only dude in a world of chicks. I know it's out there. They could even have all been lesbians, and I would just watch. I'd be good with whatever. Anyway, after that, I started just sliding through worlds. Worlds, worlds, worlds. I stopped caring. It was like when you've surfed too much porn on the web and none of it seems real, but you keep on going anyway. I'd get to a world and immediately start looking for any excuse to quit and go on to the next one. As soon as I'd see one wrong thing, oh, this one has flies, or the sky is a weird color, or no beer, anything that wasn't perfect, I'd bail. Then one of those times I came back, and the whole Netherlands was busted. What? How do you mean busted? Broken. Fucked up. Do you know about this? If I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. He drained his wine glass. A man came to refill it, and Josh waved him off. Whiskey, he said. He went on. At first I thought it was me. I must have broken it. I used it too much, something like that. When my head broke the water that last time, it was like the cold punched me in the face. The air was freezing, and the wind was just whipping this dry, powdery snow through the squares. How is that even possible? Quentin said. I didn't think the Netherlands even had weather. It made him think of that silent storm, the one that had thrashed the clock tree back in Fillory. Maybe it was the same wind? Something's deeply messed up there, Quentin. Something's wrong. Something basic, like systemic. Half the buildings were in ruins. It looked like the place had been bombed. All those beautiful stone buildings just laid open to the sky. Do you remember how Penny said once that they were all full of books? I think he was right, because the air was full of pages blowing along through the city. Josh shook his head. I guess I should have grabbed a few to see what was on them. You would have. I never even thought of it till after. You know what I was thinking about? Not dying. I was pretty far from the earth fountain at that point, a mile maybe. I'd brought warm clothes, but I ditched them when I met the harpy. It was hot as hell there, and she kind of tore at my clothes a lot of the time anyway. So I was practically naked, and a lot of my landmarks were gone. A lot of the fountains were gone, too. Some of them were leveled, some of them were frozen. You know how you can't really do magic there? A couple of times I just squatted down in a corner. I thought maybe I'd wait out the storm, but really I just wanted to go to sleep. I didn't think I could go on. I could have died easily. I was out there for about half an hour. It's a miracle I found the earth fountain at all. I really thought I wouldn't make it."
"It's incredible that you did." "Good old Josh. Just when you were ready to write him off, he kicked into gear, and when he did, he really was indomitable. Like that time in Fillory when he'd beaten the red-hot giant with his black hole spell. He'd probably outlive them all."
"I keep trying to figure it out," Josh said. "It was like somebody'd attacked the Netherlands or cursed it. Except, who could do that? I didn't see anybody there. It was just as empty as it always was. I thought maybe, I know it's silly, I thought maybe I'd see Penny."
"Yeah. I mean, not that I wanted to. I couldn't stand that guy. But it'd be nice to know he's not dead."
"Yeah, it would."
Quentin was already trying to calculate whether this meant he and Julia couldn't get back to Fillory through the Netherlands. It was still possible in theory. They'd just suit up for cold weather, bring an ice axe.
"I always thought the Netherlands were invulnerable," Quentin said. "They felt like they were outside time. I didn't think they ever changed. But it sounds like an earthquake hit them, an earthquake and a blizzard at the same time."
"I know, right? What are the odds?"
"I don't suppose you noticed whether the Fillory fountain was still there," Quentin said. "I thought maybe we'd go back that way, back to Fillory."
"No."
"So you are going back? I didn't exactly pop in while I was passing through."
"But listen, I don't know if you can go back that way anyway."
"Why not? I realize the Netherlands is a disaster area, but it's worth a try. You got back to Earth. You seem pretty settled here. We'll just borrow the button and be on our way."
"Yeah, see, that's the thing."
Josh didn't meet Quentin's eyes. He studied a painting hanging on the flaking wall behind Quentin, as if he'd never seen it before.
"What?"
"I don't have the button anymore."
"You don't?"
"Yeah, I sold it. I didn't realize you still wanted it."
Quentin could not be hearing this.
"You didn't. Tell me you did not do that."
"I totally did," Josh said, indignant. "How the hell do you think I could afford a fucking Venetian palazzo?"
Chapter 14. The old wood of Josh's dining room table felt cool against Quentin's forehead. In a few more seconds, he'd sit up again. That's how long it would take to roll his brain back to the state it was in before it thought that their troubles were over. Until that happened, Quentin would just enjoy the cool solidity of the table for a second more. He let the despair wash over him. The button was gone. He thought about banging his head a few times, just lightly, but that would have been overdoing it. He was aware for the first time of how quiet the city had gotten. After dark, the streets and canals seemed to empty out, as if Venice felt less of an obligation to pretend to be part of this millennium at night and had reverted to its medieval self again. "All right." He sat up. The blood drained back out of his face. Back to work. "Okay. You sold the button."
"Look, you must have had some other plan," Josh said. "I mean, don't tell me you were actually planning on randomly running into me in Venice and bumming the button off me. That's not a plan."
"Well, no," Quentin said. "It's not a plan. The plan was not to get booted out of Fillory, but that ship has sailed, so I'm working on a new plan."
"Who the hell did you sell the button to?"
"Well, that's a story, too." Josh launched straight into the tale, untroubled by any further self-reproach. If Quentin had moved on, then so could he, and this was obviously a much happier story than the one about his sojourn in the Netherlands. "See, I realized I was through with that button. I was done with the Netherlands and Fillory and all that stuff. If I was going to get laid, and I was going to get laid right here in the real world. So I looked around for something to do on Earth, and I started picking up on this underground scene. The safe houses, all that stuff. Have you heard about that?"
"Julia's been catching me up."
I mean, I always knew there were hedge witches out there, a few of them, but this thing goes deep, man. I had no idea. There are a lot of those guys, and a lot of them come through Venice. They figure it's really old, so, hey, magic. They think maybe they'll pick something up. It's kind of sad, really. Some of them are their business. They've figured out a lot of what we know, and some stuff we don't. But most of them have no idea what they're doing, and they're desperate. They'll try anything. You gotta watch yourself around the desperate ones. They don't know enough to be dangerous, most of them, but they attract scavengers, fairies and demons and whatever. Fucking jackals. That's where you get problems. The predators don't mess around with us because we're too much trouble, but those poor bastards, the hedge magicians, they want power and they'll do anything to get it. I've heard of them striking some pretty bad bargains. But you know what? I like them. You know, I never fit in that well at Brakebill's. The whole fake Oxford thing with the wine tasting and the fancy dress and all that. That was always more your scene, you and Elliot, and Janet. He almost mentioned Alice, but swerved away at the last second. And it was great, don't get me wrong, but it's just not my style. I get along better with the underground people. People thought I was a joke at Brakebill's, but here, I'm a big wheel. I guess I just got tired of being the bottom of the food chain. Nobody really appreciated me there. No, not even you, Quentin. Not really. But here, I'm like the king. Quentin could have denied it, but no, he couldn't really. It was true. Everybody loved Josh, but nobody took him seriously. He'd allowed himself to think that it was because Josh didn't want to be taken seriously, but that wasn't true at all. Of Josh, or probably of anybody. Everybody wanted to be the hero of their own story. Nobody wanted to be comic relief. Josh had probably been carrying that around as long as Quentin had known him. No wonder he gave them a hard time in that room with the bowl. So is that why you sold the button? Because you felt like we didn't take you seriously? Josh looked wounded. I sold the button because I got offered a fuckload of money for it. But would that have been a bad reason? Look, I had a little anger to deal with. They treat me with respect here. I never knew what that was like before. I'm the bridge between the two worlds. There's things you can't get in the underground that I know how to find, and vice versa. So people come to me with problems from both sides. It's actually pretty wild. The underground scene has shit we never could have gotten our hands on, and they don't even know it. They have these sad little swap meets, and then something really legendary turns up totally at random, and they don't even recognize it. One time I found a Cherenkov sphere. Nobody knew what it was. I had to show them how to hold it. So what about the button? Did you sell that at a swap meet? Yeah, you might well ask that, Josh said, unfazed. That was more of a special transaction, a one-off, high-status client. Yeah, I bet. Maybe you could put me in touch with your high-status client. Maybe he'll want to have a special transaction with me, too. No harm in trying, but I can't say I love your chances. Josh was grinning like a lunatic. There was obviously a secret there that he was dying to blow. Tell me. Okay, Josh held up his hands, setting the scene. So, after I get back from the Netherlands, I'm knocking around New York just enjoying that I still have all my extremities. When I get a call on my cell from this guy, he says, meet me tomorrow in Venice. Business to discuss, confidential matter, whatever. I'm like, fine, I guess, but I'm kind of short on cash, so how's that going to work? I'm just walking along the sidewalk having this conversation, and even as I'm saying it, this Bentley slides up next to me and the door opens. Like an idiot, I get in and we're off to LaGuardia where there's a private jet waiting. I mean, how does he even know where I am? How does he know I don't have something important going on that day? Yeah, how would he have ever guessed that? Old habits die hard. Josh didn't catch the irony anyway. I know, right? Clean miss. Plus there's an overnight bag for me with all these clothes and things in it. Really nice clothes that fit me. And that toothpaste that costs like $7. Anyway, I'm supposed to meet the guy on such and such a dock at such and such a time, so I basically do, though the day when the good old-fashioned green and white American street signs come to this continent will be a merry fucking occasion, let me just say. A guy pulls up to the dock in this fancy-pants launch. Not one of your usual Venice Craporetto fart buckets. This thing is sleek. It's like a giant knife made out of wood. Totally soundless. It glides up to the dock. This guy jumps out. He doesn't even tie up the boat, just waits for him. And he's a midget. Little person. But way high-end little person. He's so well-dressed you don't even notice he's a little person. He's from this old Venetian family, a Marchese of whatever. It takes him about an hour just to say his name. But after that, things go pretty quick. He says he represents somebody who wants to buy the button. I don't even know how they know about it, but I say, who is it? He's all, I can't say. I say, how much? And he's all, $100 million. And I'm all, $200 million. $250 million. Right? Check that out. And I want to know who the buyer is, right? Now, who wasted his childhood watching like a million hours of TV? That shit is practically second nature to me. So the midget takes out an envelope, and inside the envelope is a cashier's check for $250 million. It's like he knew what I was going to say. And I'm all, and? And he waves me over with his little stubby fingers. I figured he was going to whisper something in my ear, so I stop and bend down, and he's all, no. And he keeps waving me right up to the edge of the dock, and then he points down into the water, and this face looms up at me. It just comes floating up toward the surface of the water. It's enormous. It looks like the front of a truck coming up at me. I practically shit my pants. What was it? It was a dragon. There's a dragon that lives in the Grand Canal. That's who bought the button. Quentin knew about dragons, at least in theory. There weren't many of them, and they mostly lived in rivers, one to a river. They were highly territorial. They hardly ever came out or spoke to anyone. They hardly ever did anything at all, just dreamed away the lifetime of the planet in secret fluvial oblivion. Except one of them had woken up long enough to talk to an aristocratic little person, apparently, and it had bestirred itself to show its face to Josh and to buy his, their, magic button for $250 million. So, we go to the bank, we verify that the check is valid, then we walk back to the dock. I take out the button and hand it to the little guy who's put on one white glove, Michael Jackson style. He looks at the button through a jeweler's loop. Then he walks to the edge and chucks it in the water, just like that. Then he gets in his launch and drives away. That is pretty astonishing, Quentin said. It was hard to even be mad about it, though not impossible.
Can you believe a dragon bought our button? Josh said. He knows who we are, or who I am anyway. I don't even think people knew there was a dragon in the Grand Canal. I mean, it's salt water. You know that, right? It's not actually a river. It's a tidal estuary or whatever. I don't think people know about salt water dragons.
Josh, how would I go about getting in touch with that dragon? That brought him up short.
Well, I don't know. I don't think you can.
You did.
He got in touch with me.
Well, how would you try?
Josh heaved an exasperated sigh.
All right, there is this one girl I know who knows a lot about dragons. I guess I'd ask her.
Okay, good. Listen, this is what's going to happen.
Quentin focused his will on Josh. Now hear this. He met Josh's gaze and held it. All due respect to your being king here, but Julia and I are king and queen of Fillory, and we have to get back there. For all intents and purposes, we are on a fucking quest here.
You are now on the quest team, too. I am deputizing you. We have to get back to Fillory, and we don't know how we're going to do it. That's the problem.
Josh considered.
That's a big problem.
Yeah, and you're the big fixer, right?
So let's fix it.
He'd give Josh this. Maybe he blew their only chance to get back to the secret magical land where Quentin was a king, but he bought a very nice palazzo with the money. It was a glorious, grotesque heap of 15th-century marble. The facade on the canal side was white, with its own tidy little dock out front. The interior teemed with curly plasterwork ornaments. Old oil paintings clung to the walls like lichen. Josh had accidentally acquired a minor canaletto when he bought the place. It was a serious palace, and it must have taken serious work to get it back on its feet. Josh had replumbed it and rewired it and put in a restaurant-caliber kitchen and done some work below the waterline, shoring up the foundations to keep the whole thing from slumping forward into the canal. He'd done it carefully, too, so that you wouldn't know the place had been touched until you turned on the shower. And all it had cost was $25 million, plus $10 million more for the renovation. Not that Quentin was a math genius or anything, but he figured that that left Josh with a pretty tidy nest egg. No doubt it would be a great comfort to him during his golden years. It was all a reminder that Josh had a capable and determined side that really did deserve respect, even though for his own private reasons he worked hard to keep that side hidden most of the time. Now that Quentin looked, really looked, something had changed about Josh. He was more confident. He stood differently. He'd lost weight in the Netherlands, and he'd kept it off. People changed. Time didn't stand still for you while you lounged around on cushions in Fillory. And he could learn something from Josh. Here was somebody who was having a good time. He was doing what he wanted and enjoying himself. He'd been through everything Quentin had been through. He lost the girl he loved, and he nearly died. He didn't sit around moaning and philosophizing about it. He bounced back and set himself up in a palazzo. Quentin slept like the dead till noon the next day, when he enjoyed a formal breakfast in the dining room. Josh was exceptionally proud of the table, he said. Over here they use spoons for their jam. Amazing, right? Tiny spoons. It's fit for a king. Wink, wink. They were joined by Julia, who kept her sunglasses on and ate only Marmite, straight from the jar, which, if anything, seemed like further proof of her declining humanity. They were also joined by Poppy, Josh's friend, the one who was supposed to know something about dragons. She was a beanpole, tall and skinny, with wide blue eyes and curly blonde hair. Poppy had been to Breakbills, as it happened, but only in a postgraduate capacity as a research fellow. She'd learned her magic at a college in Australia, which was where she was from. Quentin had some idea that Australians were fun-loving and easygoing, and if that was true, he could see why Poppy had gotten the hell out of Australia. She had a bright, sharp manner and a quick little voice and a lot of confidence. She was especially confident when it came to pointing out other people's mistakes. Not that she was a know-it-all. It didn't seem to be an ego thing with her. She just assumed that everybody shared her desire for everybody to be clear on everything, and she'd expect you to do the same for her. Apparently at Esquith, which was the Australian magic school in Tasmania, she'd been the academic superstar of her year. This according to Josh, but Poppy didn't contradict him, which if it weren't true would have gone against her error-hating nature. Poppy was an academic at heart, but she wasn't the ivory tower type. She was into the real world. She was into field work. Specifically, she was into dragons. Quentin supposed it was an extension of the general Australian preoccupation with fatally dangerous animals. Start with saltwater crocodiles and box jellyfish, and it was just a hop, skip, and a jump up the food chain before you got to dragons. Poppy knew about as much about them as was possible to know without actually ever having seen one. She'd followed leads all over the world,
and now she'd followed one here. Josh had put out feelers for an expert on the topic, and he'd been very pleased indeed when his expert had turned out to be as good-looking as Poppy was. She'd been there for 3 weeks, and Josh didn't feel she'd worn out her welcome. He introduced her as his friend, but given who Josh was, and given Poppy's undeniable prettiness, Quentin didn't think it was uncharitable to assume that Josh was trying to sleep with her, or had already slept with her. He was new and improved, but he was still Josh. Frankly, Poppy got on Quentin's nerves a bit, but she was about to come in extremely handy. Josh had yet to give her the full download about the Dragon of the Grand Canal. He told Quentin he'd been slow playing it in an attempt to prolong her visit. But now the moment had arrived. They needed her. Needless to say, Poppy was beyond excited. Her wide blue eyes got even wider.
"Well, okay," she said, talking at a runaway clip. "So, most of the dragons have a place where you're supposed to be able to jump into their river and they'll notice. They monitor it just in case somebody worth their while wants to talk to them. If they want to talk to you, they'll take you down to where they live. But it's not a well-understood process at all. There are a lot of urban legends around it. Lots of people say they've talked to dragons, but it's very hard to verify. Supposedly, the Thames Dragon wrote most of Pink Floyd's stuff, at least after Sid Barrett left, but there's no way to prove it. Traditionally, you approach them via the first bridge upstream from the sea. In this case, I guess the Academia. Haven't you guys all heard this stuff? I can't believe you haven't heard about this. Go at midnight. Go to the middle of the bridge, take a copy of today's newspaper and a nice steak. Wear something nice. And that's it.
That's it?
That's it. And then you jump in. It's all just tradition. I mean, God knows if any of it helps. There's so little data, and so little of it is reliable.
And then you jump in. That was all. But it does sometimes work, Quentin said.
Sure,
Poppy nodded brightly.
Uh-huh. Some dragons like to talk more than others. The valedictorian of the magic school in Calcutta makes a run at the Ganges dragon every year, and it works about half the time.
A dragon in the Grand Canal, though. That's new. I mean, really new. I was starting to think you were full of shit.
She gave Joss a sharp, reappraising look.
Starting, Quentin said.
So, when are you going?
Tonight. But listen, do me one favor. Don't tell anybody about this yet.
Poppy frowned prettily, which seemed to be the only way she knew how.
Why not?
Just give us a week, Quentin said. That's all I ask. The dragon isn't going anywhere, and I need to get a decent chance with it. If word gets out, there's going to be a mob scene.
She thought for a second.
All right, she said.
Something about the way she said it suggested to Quentin that she might actually keep her promise. Recovering her high spirits immediately, Poppy addressed herself to her jam and toast. Thin as she was, she ate more than Josh, presumably burning it all in whatever inner furnace kept her at such a pitch of eager excitement all the time. That left the rest of the day to dispense with. Life at the Palazzo Josh, formerly the Palazzo Barberino, after the 16th-century clan that built it, and eventually sold it to a dot-com jillionaire who never set foot in it and who blew his jillions on Ponzi schemes and a trip to the International Space Station, after which he sold it to Josh, wasn't exactly taxing. He felt disloyal for thinking it, disloyal to Fillory, but he could almost get used to this. The Palazzo's comforts were many. You could spend the morning in bed, reading and watching the Venetian light track slowly over an oriental carpet that was so fractally ornate it practically scintillated right there on the floor in front of you. Then there was all of Venice to wander around, the structural spells alone, the titanic bonds that kept the whole place from drowning itself in the lagoon, were a must-see for any tourist of the world's magical wonders. Then there was the daily late-afternoon spritz. Taken altogether, it was enough to make Quentin forget for minutes at a time that once upon a time he used to be the king of a magical other world. Not Julia, though. Not quite. She found him nursing his drink on the piano nobile and admiring the cityscape over its heavy stone railing. Together, they looked down at the traffic on the canal, much of which consisted of tourists on boats looking up at them and wondering who they were and whether they were famous.
"You like it here," Julia said.
"It's amazing. I'd never even been to Italy before. I had no idea it was like this."
"I lived in France for a while," she said.
"You did?
When did you live in France?" "It was a long time ago."
"Was that where you learned to steal cars?"
"No."
Having brought it up, she didn't seem to want to talk about it.
"It's nice here," she conceded.
"Do you want to stay here?" Quentin asked. "Do you still want to go back to Fillory?" She set her glass down on the wide marble parapet. More whiskey, still neat. A muscle twinged in her jaw.
"I have to go back. I cannot stay here."
Before, when she said this, she sounded angry and desperate. Now she sounded regretful.
"I must keep going. Are you coming with me?"
It made Quentin's heart ache to hear Julia ask him for something, anything. She needed his help. People needing him. It was a new feeling. He was starting to like it. "Of course I am." It was what she'd said when he asked her to come along to the outer island. She nodded, never taking her eyes off the view.
"Thank you."
That night, at 5 minutes to midnight, Quentin was remembering that conversation and trying to hold on to that feeling as he loitered on the Ponte dell'Accademia, holding copies of Il Gazzettino and the International Herald Tribune, just to cover all the bases, and a really great, amazingly expensive raw steak, doing his very best impression of somebody who wasn't about to jump into the Grand Canal. After the crushing, malodorous heat of the day, the night air was surprisingly frigid. From the point of view of someone who was planning to immerse himself in it, the creamy green water of the Grand Canal looked about as enticing as glacial runoff. It also looked a lot farther away than it had looked from the banks. It also looked clean, which Quentin knew it wasn't. But somewhere under all that water, there was a button. And a dragon. It didn't seem real. He half suspected Josh of having lost the button in a sofa and making up the story about the dragon because it was less embarrassing.
"This is going to be really wretched, dude," Josh said. "You are not going to be a happy puppy in there."
No kidding. He'd hoped Josh would offer to do it himself or go in with him, but no such luck.
"You'll get used to it,"
Poppy said, hugging herself. "Why are you here again?" Quentin said.
"Interests of science. Plus I want to see if you'll actually go through with it."
It was a personal tic of Poppy's that she never seemed to lie when other people would. It was either tactless or admirable, depending on how you looked at it. Quentin took some deep breaths and leaned against the splintery wooden railing, which still retained some of the fading heat of the sun. "Remember what's at stake. Julia wouldn't hesitate. She'd be over the railing like a damn Olympic hurdler. At his request, they hadn't told her they were going tonight, but slipped out after she went to bed. She would have insisted on going in."
"They hardly ever eat people," Poppy said. "I mean, like, twice a century, that we know of."
Quentin didn't respond to this.
"How deep do you think it is?" Josh said.
He dragged on a cigarette. Of the three of them, he looked the most nervous.
20 feet, maybe," Quentin said. "I read it on the internet." "Jesus. Well, whatever you do, don't dive."
"If I break my neck and end up paralyzed, just let me drown."
2 minutes, Poppy said.
An empty vaporetto churned by underneath them, off duty. Lights off except for one in the cozy pilot's cabin. That water must be 90% E. coli, and the rest was probably diesel fuel. This was not a body of water intended for swimming in. Somebody had carved what might have been a stylized dragon, or just a fancy S, into the wood right at the apex of the bridge.
"Are you going to take off your clothes?" Josh asked.
"You don't know how long I've been waiting for you to ask me that."
"Seriously, are you?"
"No." Poppy said it at the same time he did.
"Seriously,"
she added. Their little group fell silent. Somewhere far away, glass broke, beer bottle versus wall. Quentin wondered if he was actually going to do this. Maybe he could just drop a note in, message in a bottle. "Call me."
"Hey, remember when that little person called your cell?" he said. "Did you get his number? Maybe we could just..."
"It was blocked."
"Time,"
Poppy said.
"Damn it."
"Just don't think about it." He backed up to the middle of the bridge, scrunched the papers and the bag with the stake in it up in one hand, ran at the railing and vaulted over it sidewise. He surprised himself by how spryly he did it. Must be the adrenaline. Even so, he almost clipped a sticking-out support beam going down. Some primal instinct caused him to flap his arms and let go of the stake and the papers in midair. They separated from him and disappeared into the night. So much for that. To his left, he caught a glimpse of something falling in parallel with him. Somebody. It was Poppy. She was jumping in, too. He hit hard, feet first, more or less, and went under. His only thought as he went down was to clench or snort out air from all possible orifices to try to avoid taking in any water or other fluids. The canal was freezing and powerfully salty. For an instant, he felt relief. It wasn't that cold. Then his clothes soaked through and turned to frozen lead, and the cold pressed in on him from all sides. He panicked and thrashed. His clothes were too heavy. They were going to drag him under. Then his head broke the surface. He'd lost a shoe. Poppy surfaced at the same moment a couple of yards away, spitting and blowing, her round face shining pale in the sodium light of the streetlights. He should have been mad at her, but the gonzo jolliness of swimming in the Grand Canal in the middle of the night made him laugh crazily instead.
"What the hell are you doing?" he stage whispered.
If nothing else, the freezing shock had taken away his irritation at her. He had to give her credit for a degree of physical courage he wouldn't have thought she possessed. They were in it together.
"Twice the chances, right? If there's two of us?"
She was grinning a loony grin, too. She lived for this shit.
"I was wrong. We should have taken our clothes off."
He treaded water. It took about 30 seconds before he was exhausted and shivering uncontrollably. The current was sweeping them under the bridge. Not the current, the tide it must be, he reminded himself, since the canal wasn't really a river.
Jesus, there could be sharks in this bitch.
Somebody yelled at them from the bank in Italian. He hoped it wasn't a cop. Quentin peed in his pants and felt warmer for 10 seconds, then even colder afterward. He tried not to think of what PCBs and other industrial toxins must be leaching their way into him upstream. From down here, the canal looked enormous, the banks miles away. How did he get here, so far from where he started? How had he gone so far off track? He felt like he would never claw his way back to where he should be, back onto his cozy throne. A wavelet popped up out of nowhere and slapped him in the face. He was ready to call it a night. At least he could say he tried.
"How long are we supposed to wait?" he asked Poppy.
Just then, an iron handcuff locked around his ankle and jerked him under. He should have died right then. Surprise made him blurt out all his air in one heave, and he went down with his lungs completely empty. But there was a spell in effect to keep him alive. It was obviously something the dragon had developed over many years for the comfort of its human visitors. It was comprehensive. It was user-friendly. It had the feel of magic finely milled by long centuries of use and cast by a past master with wings and a tail.
Quentin wasn't going to die, or at least not by accident. In fact, he felt warm, for the first time in what seemed like hours, and he could see clearly, if dimly, which he shouldn't have been able to do. He was breathing the water. It wasn't quite like breathing air. It had more heft to it. More push and shove was required to get it in and out of his chest, but it got the job done. Oxygen continued to reach his brain. He heaved it in and out, gratefully, in big gulps. He felt relaxed. Somebody was taking care of him. He was flying first class. Quentin had always had reservations about dragons, the real ones anyway, the ones that actually existed. He'd been raised on the tradition of high-flying, gold-hoarding, fire-breathing dragons, Beowulf dragons, Tolkien dragons, Dungeons and Dragons dragons. The news that real dragons lived in rivers and didn't go thundering around the countryside setting trees on fire had come as a disappointment to him. River dragons sounded colder and slimier and more newt-like than what he'd been hoping for. So he was happy to see that the dragon that had hold of his ankle with its short but powerful right forelimb, drawing him down and placing him gently on the canal floor like a puppy to whom it was saying, "Stay," was thoroughly, almost quintessentially draconian. It looked sinister and coldly calculating and like it could eat him without noticing. But it was canonical. Its massive Saurian head was the size of a compact car. Its eyes flashed silver when you caught them at the right angle. Its scales were a delicate, watery green. Having settled him on the soft sand, the dragon of the Grand Canal released him and crouched down in a cat-like pose, resting its head on the tip of its tail. Its vast body humped up in the dimness behind it. Quentin sneezed. His sinuses had flooded with filthy water when the dragon yanked him down, but the water around him now was clean. He was enclosed with the dragon in a quiet green-black dome of water. The canal bed, which should have been a swamp of trash and scrap metal and sewage, was smooth. The dragon kept its patch of sand well tended. Quentin sat cross-legged. It was just the two of them. The dragon hadn't taken Poppy, apparently. Quentin was having a little trouble not floating away, but he found something round and heavy next to him, an old cannonball maybe, and settled it in his lap to hold him down. He let a minute go by, but the dragon didn't talk. All right. Game on. "Hello," Quentin said. His voice sounded basically normal, just distant, as if he were eavesdropping on himself from another room. "Thank you for seeing me." The huge face didn't move. It was as unreadable as a skull. Though there went the eyes, flashing again. "Probably you know why I came here. I want to talk to you about the button, the one you bought from my friend Josh." He felt like a kid asking the school bully for his lunch money back. He straightened his spine. "The thing is, it wasn't entirely his to sell. It also belonged to me and some other people, and we need it. I need it to get back to my home, and my friend Julia does too."
"I know."
The dragon's voice was like some vast string instrument two levels below double bass, an octuple bass maybe, playing a perfect fifth. He felt the vibrations in his ribs and in his balls. "Will you help us? Will you give us back the button, or sell it back to us?" The rest of the canal was a solid wall of darkness around them. There was a distant rumble, and Quentin risked a glance up. A late-night barge was thundering by overhead. It felt like the water was getting chillier, or maybe he was cooling off. He scooched a little closer to the dragon, who was giving off heat. If it was going to eat him, it was going to eat him, and at least he'd die warm.
"No," came the reply.
The dragon's eyes closed and opened. The door back to Fillory was shutting. He had to stick his foot in it. That world, the world of his real life, the life he was supposed to be living, was drifting away, or he was drifting away from it. The moorings had been cut, and the tide was flowing out. They never should have gone to After Island. They never should have left Castle Whitespire. "Maybe you could loan it to us?" He willed the desperation out of his voice. "A one-time trip. If there's anything I have that you want, I'm offering it. I'm a king, in Fillory at least. I have a lot of resources there."
"I did not bring you here to listen to you boast."
"I'm not—"
"I have lived in this canal for 10 centuries. Everything that enters it is mine. I have swords and crowns. I have popes and saints and kings and queens. I have brides on their wedding day and children on Christmas. I have the holy lance and the noose that hung Judas. I have every lost thing."
"Fair enough." Quentin wondered if Byron had ever been down here. If he had, he probably thought of something clever to say. "Okay. All right. But I don't understand. Why did you bring me here if you don't want to sell me back the button?" The dragon's pupils widened until they were almost a foot across, and it seemed to come awake and really notice him for the first time. Its head lifted off its tail. He was close enough that it had to go slightly cross-eyed to focus on him. Now that Quentin's eyes had adjusted to the dark, he could make out the big scales on the dragon's back. They looked as thick as encyclopedias, and a few of them had things carved into them, sigils and pictograms that Quentin didn't recognize.
"You will not speak again, human, except to thank me," the dragon said. "You wish to be a hero, but you do not know what a hero is. You think a hero is one who wins, but a hero must be prepared to lose, Quentin. Are you prepared to lose everything?"
"I've already lost everything," he said.
"Oh, no. You have so much more left to lose."
The dragon was a lot scoldier than he expected, and disappointingly cryptic. Somehow, in the back of his mind, he'd vaguely thought that the dragon might want to be his friend, and they would fly around the world solving mysteries together. The chances of that happening now looked vanishingly small. He waited. Maybe the dragon would give him something they could use.
"The old gods are returning to take back what is theirs. I will play my part. Best you prepare to play yours."
"That sounds like a good idea, but how exactly—"
"You will not speak. The button is useless to you. The Netherlands are closed, but the first door is still open. It always has been."
Quentin's knees suddenly felt stiff from sitting cross-legged. He wanted to spit the salt water out of his mouth, but there was nothing but more salt water to spit into. The dragon whipped its tail out from under its chin, back into the darkness, slashing up a cloud of silt.
"You may thank me now."
"Wait, what?" Quentin opened his mouth to speak, to thank the dragon of the Grand Canal like a good boy, or to ask him what he meant, or tell him to fuck off for talking in riddles. He would never know, because he choked instead. He couldn't breathe. The spell was gone, and he was gagging on filthy, freezing canal water. He was drowning. He left his one remaining shoe stuck in the mud and kicked his way crazily up toward the surface. Chapter 15. Oh, the return of the prodigal! The rapture with which Julia was received back into the domestic fold!
the blurry, beaming faces of her parents, a pair of rain-soaked headlights trained upon her as she presented herself to them in the form of a reprobate reformed. She had disappointed them so many times, in so many ways, they hardly dared to hope any more. They'd been through so many stages of grief they'd lost count. Now, here she was,